The Mooney Show on RTE Radio 1. Text now to 51551 or email mooney@rte.ie.
Yes, tough luck on the Irish team today, but they'll be back. I have no doubt they're a great team, the men in green. Anyway, there's an old saying that you can't keep a good thing down, and when that good thing happens to have been the main songwriting talent, and take that, it's hardly surprising that Gary Barlow has kept bouncing back onto our television screens. It's nearly 25 years since Take That took the world by storm with their first number one hit, It Only Takes a Minute. Can you remember it? But it was a year or so later that Gary first showed his songwriting mettle when he took the band to the top of the charts again with his own composition, A Million Love Songs. Phenomenal global success enjoyed by the band is well known to all of us, and now a new talent show on BBC One is looking for 5 performers to play a boy band in the brand new musical that features the music of Take That. The show, devised by Gary Barlow, is hosted by our very own Graham Norton and Mel of Mel and Sue fame. There is another Irish interest, 20-year-old Conor McLaughlin, who's a waiter from Dublin, is one of the competitors. And last weekend, he wowed the judges with this rendition of Elton John's Your Song. And you can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done. Conor competes again tonight, and he'll need to be awarded at least 15 points by the judges to get through to the next round, so we wish him the very best of luck. Ireland is with you, Conor. How wonderful life is now you're in the world. Can you imagine that song was actually written 36 years before Conor was even born? And he's out there singing it and giving it socks. Smelly socks at that. Anyway, the very best of luck again, Conor. It's on BBC One this evening. You'll be able to tune in, find out when it's on yourself. I think it's around 20% or something like that. Because we don't want you switching off here. It's 20% or something like that. So anyway, you can watch it later on. Anyway, thank you for joining us. From one Dubliner to another, Dermot Bulger is a well-known novelist, playwright and poet who is about to shed light on the extraordinary lives of some of Ireland's towering literary giants, legends like Oscar Wilde, James Joyce and Brendan Behan, because the Herald newspaper is launching a series of features about these famous names, and Dermot Bulger has authored the first part of the series. Dermot, you're very welcome to the programme. It's my first time meeting you, though I've heard you a gazillion times on the radio and all that kind of stuff. So it's lovely to meet you. Now, I mentioned, while we know these great names and the names of their great works, we know very little about their actual lives, like the likes of Bernard Shaw. Tell me about them.
Well, Bernard, they're all fascinating. For different reasons. We lost a great writer in Anthony Cronin just last month, and the paper said that he was 88, but Tony was actually 3 hours away from his 93rd birthday, because, as he often told me, it's a very ageist city, and if you told me your real age, you wouldn't get the gigs. And even at the age of 91, Tony was looking for the gigs, because that's what writers do. And George Bernard Shaw was 96 years of age when he died, and he died by falling out of a tree, of an apple tree that he was tending to in his own garden.
And that's extraordinary. Is that true?
It is true. And
how did he get into the tree in the first place?
He was a vegetarian, and it says a lot for vegetarianism. So if you get to be 96 and you're vegetarian and you have apple trees, stay out of them is the answer. But he began his career at the age of 15 as a clerk in an office in Molesworth Street. He was from a very prosperous Protestant family in Sing Street, but his father was an alcoholic and the marriage and his business broke up, and Shaw had to go to work at the age of 15 and used to walk around to the National Gallery of Ireland, and he felt that his real university was the National Gallery of Ireland. And when he died, he left part of his estate. So every time My Fair Lady has done somewhere, the National Gallery get a small check.
Well, he described himself as a social downstart. Is that true?
Yes, because everybody else was an upstart, but he actually sort of, his family went downhill. He would have expected to have had a fairly affluent upbringing. He probably would have gone to Trinity College like people like Wilde did and others. But he wound up having to work at the age of 15, went to London to try and make his fortune at the age of 20. And it was, and I think that's possibly why, as I try and explain in the series and try and examine these lives, he was still working at the age of 96.
Because it was in him.
Because it was in him. If you're a self-made man, a self-made woman, I think you never stop.
And no, you always chase the next gig. That's the way it is. You think it's going to end tomorrow, isn't it? Actually, yeah. I remember seeing a very interesting documentary called Tantrum and Tiaras. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's about Elton John. Mm-hmm. It was made maybe about 10 years ago by David Furnish. Isn't that his partner's name, David Furnish? I always tempted to say Furnace when I say that man's name. Anyway.
Elton is one of the famous Dubliners I'm not doing.
Oh, is it? No, but in it, they talk about longevity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what would you do if it all ended tomorrow? And he said, it won't end tomorrow. That's not the way it is. I've served my apprenticeship and I will keep going. This guy just keeps going and going and going and
Samuel
going.
Samuel Beckett, who I also cover in the series, was asked what he felt his last day on earth would be like. And it would say it would be like any other day, only shorter. And I presume, ironically, Beckett had, when he lived in a nursing home at the end of his life, he had a television under his bed, which he never took out except when Ireland played rugby. And he would watch Ireland play rugby and open a bottle of Irish whiskey and watch it. So today, if he was alive, would have been one of the 6 days in the year when he would have broken out the whiskey and the television.
God, I wonder would he have poured it down the drain, though?
I think, well, you know, Beckett had a very stoic attitude to life, so I think he would have taken out a feat fairly well. You know?
Well, he would have. Yeah, ever tried, ever failed. No matter. Try again, fail better. Anyway, listen, Bob Dylan recently joined Shaw in achieving a unique distinction, and you mentioned Pygmalion earlier.
Yes, in that Bernard Shaw had won the Nobel Prize. He didn't actually want to accept it in 1925, and his wife, who was a very, very rich, affluent English woman, said to him, listen, it would be great for that little nation you're from who've been through a civil war, and it would teach them manners, and it would be very, very good, a civilising effect, if you accepted the Nobel Prize. So he didn't accept the money, but he accepted the award. Yeats was the opposite, because Yeats was a walking poet, and in 1923, when Yeats won the Nobel Prize, and the Irish Times phoned and told Yeats what a great honour it was for the country, Yeats interrupted and said, how much money is it worth? Because he was a very practical man, and then they celebrated with the only thing in the house, which was sausages.
No way. Bangers. But didn't Shaw write a response to the Hollywood producer who tried to haggle with him over the rights?
Well, yeah, I mean, Shaw had an interest in money, and as I explained, I heard when they tried to bag him down, and they said that it would be a great tragedy if such a work of great art didn't reach a wide public because of mere money. And Shaw telegrammed back and said, dear sir, as a businessman you think only of art, as an artist I think only of money.
And his views on prostitution were fairly controversial for his time.
His views on most things were controversial, and some of them he got very, very right. And he actually sort of, Mrs. Warren's Profession, it's about prostitution, yeah, and it was about how women were enslaved by men, and he got that really, really well. He got things like his views on the Soviet Union were totally crackpot, and he viewed Stalin as a great man, and he was totally wrong. So, you know, even great men can get things totally wrong.
So he's full of contradictions.
He was. We're all born under the sign of contradiction.
Now, Transylvania, moving on, it seems like quite away from Dublin, but it's exactly where Bram Stoker created one of the most famous characters in popular culture, and that is Count Dracula.
Well, next week, next Wednesday in the Hill, like, I get to do Bram Stoker, who's a wonderful figure, and he actually, his wife was proposed to by Oscar Wilde, and she dodged the bullet by turning down Wilde and settling for her neighbour in Clontarf, who was 7 years older and was a very, very staid civil servant called Bram Stoker, who'd written only one book, which was a guide on how to be a good civil servant. And Stoker also reviewed plays for an evening paper in Dublin, and when Henry Irvine, the great actor, came over, he was so mesmerised that he abandoned his conventional career and became Irvine's servant for 27 years.
I think that's a bit bizarre. He went over. Was he having an affair with Irving?
No, he actually just loved the theatre, and he actually had a very prosperous thing, but when Dracula came out, it was totally stunned everybody, because he just seemed this very, very staid, ordinary guy. But although Transylvania is a long way from Ireland, his mother had grown up in Sligo and had seen, beside the asylum, and seen episodes of cholera and seen people from the poorhouse literally being buried alive and Catholic priests using whips to try and stop the waters throwing people in before into.
And I suppose the famine as well.
And all the similar
famine.
So,
on her life,
so
yeah.
Although Transylvania and Dracula seems a very, very long way from Ireland, I sort of think that it's informed by the Irish famine, and also that whole class of very prosperous Protestant people who felt that their whole lives were being torn apart. And so there's a whole tradition of, like, the ghost story. Almost every Hammer horror film you ever saw was written originally by a Dublin writer, by Sheridan Le Fanu or by Bram Stoker. And they're all of that Protestant ascendancy class who felt that with Catholic emancipation, their privileged world was slipping away. So you can read it, Dracula, as a wonderful horror story.
The
in
demons within them.
Or you can also read it as a metaphor for how Ireland was changing.
Yeah, but do you not think it's a bit odd? I mean, he's married and he goes off. He meets Henry Irvine, the famous actor, and he goes off. Does he go to live with him? Does he becomes his personal assistant or something?
Well,
like that?
He becomes
the wife. What happens to the wife?
Manager. Well, the wife had a very happy time of it. Stoker's mother was a very, very social, snobby woman, and really felt that the success family was his brother, who became the head of the College of Surgeons in Ireland. But she felt that Dracula had potential to make money, but it didn't make money for Stoker himself. And when he died, the book was virtually forgotten, and any obituaries were about his relationship with Henry Irvine. But after his death, film came in, and suddenly all these versions of Dracula began to appear, and Stoker's wife sued and received $40,000 for the film rights, and did that most very practical thing for a very practical Victorian woman. It was used the money to build a downstairs loo in her house in London, which he called Drac's Room.
Would have been a lot of money then as well, $40,000.
It would have been a lot of money.
Huge amount of money, I suppose. But he never benefited from it himself.
Well, no, because the book had been virtually forgotten. And when he was so linked to Henry Irvine that when Irvine died, suddenly he was out of touch and out of fashion. But, the writers, there's only one part of this whole series. And I'm going to do eight writers, and then there's going to be eight musicians, and then there's going to be eight iconic Dublin women, and then there's going to be eight political women, and so it's, the Herald is 125 years old, and it's a chance, really. What I love about the series is that I write about them, but also they reprint the actual pages from, say, last week, from when James Joyce died, or when the Oscar Wilde trial, and so it's fascinating to read those old newspapers. And very often, when Joyce died, Joyce's death wasn't even the big story in the paper. It was around the third or fourth story. And sometimes you read these really small little accounts of...
Why would that have been, do you think?
Because he was out of the picture. He was regarded with great suspicion in Ireland. And the papers are very... You know, the Herald is the Dublin paper, and it was full of Dublin news. It was two men in Cabinteely were arrested for coursing on a bus. And you've all these little small stories merged in. So actually, while I love writing for the Herald, and I love reading the big stories, when they reprint these old papers, I love the little... The novelist in me looks at the little stories and says, that's the story.
Well,
no,
I have to say, if I looked at a page and I saw the death of James Joyce or the death of Oscar Wilde, whatever the case may be, and I saw two men arrested for cursing on a bus in Cabinteely, I wonder what the curse was, what the conversation was about. Wouldn't everybody, in fairness, we know who the other guys are, we have an idea about them, what kind of things they say, a little bit more colourful. But these fellas, what do they say? So you're covering Wilde as well. I've nothing to declare but my genius. That's a famous quote from him, is it?
No,
did he actually say it? Everybody believes he did.
Not. He did say some wonderful things. He says, always forgive your enemies because nothing annoys them so much, which I've always tried to apply to life. And he always said to be yourself because everybody else is taken. But the line that he allegedly said to US Customs, I've nothing to declare but my genius, seems to have been invented around 20 years after his death. And when you're famous, very often myths and legends accrue around you, and I think that's just part and parcel of being famous, and things that are attributed to you.
And he never let facts get in the way of a good story.
He never did.
No, isn't that true? Did he get that from his parents? Is that true? Were they a bit unconventional?
Well, his parents were very, very flamboyant. His mother once banned somebody from the house because they were described as respectable, and she says only tradespeople are respectable. And she was a flamboyant nationalist poet who never rose before noon. His father was an antiquarian and an eye and ear surgeon who had a very hands-on approach with his patient. There used to be in the 50s, there was a line of not safe in taxis was used to describe certain types of men that a young woman shouldn't be with. And Oscar Wilde's father wasn't safe in taxis or in surgeries.
Now, the theme kind of running through Wilde's work is the notion of people leading secret lives. He was obsessed by this one. He led a fairly secret life in public himself.
He led, and when I was 14, the first adult book I read was A Picture of Dorian Gray, and I knew it was about something, but I didn't know what it was. And then, of course, they're really about being a gay man. in that time when it was, and the consequences for Wilde of being exposed as a gay man were terrible. He served 2 years of had servitude in Reading Prison and sort of broke
him. He could have avoided
health.
That though, couldn't he?
Well, he could have fled to London. Mm. But when you look at the importance of being earnest, and you look at sort of a lot of his... of his comedies, they're all about men going bunburying, and they're all about secret lives and secret names and identities. And I think you can read them as just as entertainment, but you can also read them as gay plays.
Where do you put yourself, Dermot, among these famous Dublin writers? Because you're a writer of some note yourself.
Well,
yourself up there with them.
I don't. I'm a man who actually tells stories for a living, and I've got suddenly very old. I just simply tell. I write novels. I write plays. I write poetry. And sometimes when you're asked to write for one of the papers, it's lovely because if you write a novel, it takes 3 or 4 years. But if you're asked to write something for the paper, it's in the paper the next day, and you're meeting people on the street who read your work in that way. And so it's a lovely thing to balance out being a novelist and a playwright, and also then just writing for the national papers. And long may our national papers survive, because they're really important to the culture of a society.
We have a text in here that says, "I think Dermot Bulger is the only genuinely brilliant contemporary writer we have. By the way, Drax Jax sounds better, don't you think?"
Drax Jax sounds like a song that will be sung on Hill 15, you know? So if any young Stokers are playing Fianna Fáil, maybe we'd be singing that one day, you know?
Now, you've adapted James Joyce's Ulysses for a stage production, which is going to be in the Dublin Theatre Festival this year.
It's going to be in the Abbey. I adapted it 23 years ago, and it was forgotten for 23 years. And it's wonderful. And many nights are sold out already. And I think there's a great fascination with Joyce. And people are intimidated by the whole Joyce industry. And at the heart of Ulysses, you actually have these very, very... Leopold Bloom he's Jewish. He's not regarded as Irish in a way that people don't regard black taxi drivers as Irish, even when they're born in Ireland. No, yeah. Bloom is that sort of outsider, and he slays his dragons. He slays enemies one by one. He's lost a child, and himself and Molly are estranged. And there's a very human story at the heart of it. And I just wanted to get to that human story. And bizarrely, it was actually did a tour of China last year. And that was really, really
strange.
Your
adaptation?
My adaptation.
And how did it go?
Ulysses. It went, there's a BBC television documentary about it, and it seemed to go really, really well. Except that every city in China has its own censor. And so in every city, they had to come, and we had to take something out. Some little scene or some little line that actually the censor in Beijing didn't like, or the censor somewhere else didn't like. And so I wound up having these really strange...
Can you
strange
remember the most innocuous thing you took out?
Well, I can remember the least innocuous, and if we can have this conversation after midnight, I will tell you.
But there's no watershed on radio, so I wouldn't worry about it. Tell me about your dad, if you wouldn't mind.
My father
was a seafarer, wasn't he?
There are two types of men. There are men who actually do things and do brave things, and my father was like that, and they don't talk about him at all. And then there's men who do nothing, like Donald Trump, and all they do is talk. And my father was a sailor on those small Irish ships that sailed to Lisbon during the war. He was bombed 3 or 4 times. This was the only way to bring back vital national supplies. I once asked him, what did you bring back on your last ship, on your last trip to Lisbon? And he said, Cork for making stoppers for Guinness bottles and Alta wine, which don't strike me as vital national supplies, but when you got to Lisbon, you had to bring back whatever you could find. I recently wrote a novel about him called A Lonely Sea in the Sky, but it's not about him, it's about his generation of sailors who actually went out and risked their lives, because British ships sailed in convoys, totally blacked out with destroyers from. Irish ships sailed totally alone, totally unarmed. They were tiny, they were only meant for going between Arklow and Dundalk and else, and suddenly they were crossing the Bay of Biscay. And the most famous ship was called the Kerlogue, and one day a German plane flew overhead. They presumed they were going to be attacked, as they had been attacked so often before, but instead they signalled SOS, and these Irish men turned starboard, and they encountered 148 German sailors dying in the water. And over the course of 11 hours they actually slowly brought every man on board. 4 died of their wounds, and the rest came back to Cove and spent the rest of the year in the cover. And for me it was an extraordinary story to tell, and I just had to understand the world of these men who went out. The minute your ship sank, your wages stopped. If you were on an Irish ship,
even if you lived,
Even if you lived, if you were from the minute the actual torpedo hit the ship, if you got into a lifeboat, the wage clerk in Stafford's or in Palmgrave or an Irish shipping stopped your wages. And that wasn't Irish thing, it was a British thing. So these men risked their lives and saw terrible things. And my the man who brought my father to sea drowned 6 weeks after the Kellogg sailed all those German lives. A tiny ship called Cymric from Arklow, a little schooner, was sunk, and so many Irish men lost their lives, and they've never really been recognised because we're a bit awkward about our neutrality in Ireland, so they've never really been recognised. And The Loneliest Sea in the Sky was my attempt to try and give them some acknowledgement and to tell their story.
Well, good for you. Now, talk to me before you go about the messenger boy and Yeats. Was that you?
No, when I people imagine that writers lead very, very extraordinary lives. When I was 15, like Shaw, I actually began walking, and I walked in wire and cable in Unander in Finglas. And because I like poems, they brought me to meet an old man, and the old man was 65, called Charlie. And Charlie had been a messenger boy. And Charlie used to see this man with a shock of white hair wandering through Dublin, and his arms were flailing out. And he said to a policeman, "Who's that big idiot?" And the man says, "That's no big idiot. That's Willie Yeats. He's a great man for the poems." And 3 or 4 weeks later, Charlie was sent out as a messenger boy to deliver a parcel to Riversdale House in Mathfarnham. And W.B. Yeats, this sort of great august poet, opened the door. And Charlie says, "Oh, here you are, a great man for the old poems." Yeah. And Yeats said, "Who told us? A peeler told me that.
Yeah.
And Yeats brought him in and actually had lemonade. And Charlie recited part of Julius Caesar to him. And they had this wonderful afternoon. And I think it was a great thing because Yeats, at the end of his life, when he won the Nobel Prize, he was a senator, he was a 60-year-old smiling public man, and everybody treated him with huge reverence. And yet Charlie was just a simple messenger boy. And gradually, I mean, I knew Francis Stewart, who was Yeats' son-in-law almost, and that he was married to Maud Gonne's daughter, Isolde. And he used to say, and Yeats' wife, George, used to have leave a note on the door of the bedroom saying, "Willie, this is not your bedroom tonight," because he would wander around. And these were very, very ordinary men. And they had foibles, and they had, poor Ben and Bean, they had alcoholism and diabetes, which sort of killed them. But in the end, they were writers, and they sat down every day and they tried to tell stories that made sense of their world. And I think
sure
that were all writers tried to do.
Sure, people are going to really enjoy this. The magazine on Dublin's literary icons will appear each Wednesday with the Herald newspaper, and it's there already, so you can get a copy next week. And then who will be there next week again?
Next week we have George Bernard Shaw, and we have Bram Stoker,
and
we have Beckett and O'Casey, and we have other, and then it's going to go on.
And then,
to,
as you said, musicians and everything else. It'll keep going.
This city.
You'll
and
be dropping
so
dead writing the last one about yourself.
People, you know?
And Dermot Bulger's latest novel, The Lonely Sea and the Sky, based on the dangerous wartime voyages of Irish sailors like his dad, is published by New Island Books at €13.99 and available from all good bookshops. All those details on the website, rte.ie/Mooney. Dermot, thank you very much indeed for coming in.
My pleasure, Derek.
The Mooney Show on RTE Radio 1.
Visit the website anytime you like. It's rte.ie/Mooney, and you can get a download of all of the interviews we do on the programme. You can listen to the podcast there and all the information that you might need about books or whatever the case might be that you're looking for. It will be there, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, here's something that'll take you back in time. I love this one.
So goodbye, Machine Dorkin. Sure, I'm sick and tired of working. No more I'll dig the parades. No longer I'll be fool. For sure's my name is Carney.
That's a goal. Now, it's 50 years since singer and entertainer Johnny McAvoy got his first break when he recorded the hit Machine Dorkin. He swiftly followed that with another number one, The Boston Burglar. And the rest, as they say, is history, because since then he's enjoyed a long and illustrious career, both nationally and internationally, as one of Ireland's favourite singing and songwriting balladeers. He's just released a new album, Into the Cauldron, and he's here now to sing for us. This is all one about a cowboy, Johnny. It's all yours.
Every night I dream of being a cowboy, just like I saw them on the movie screen, riding easy on a golden pony, not caring where I'm going or where I've been. The night is drawing in out on the prairie. I sit and watch
the evening sun go down. I listen to the lowing of the cattle and lay my sleeping blanket on the ground. I walk beside the ghosts of the long gone heroes, guys I loved when I was just a boy. Jesse James, White Earp, and William Bonney, names that I remember till I die. Every night I dream of being a cowboy, just like I saw them on the movie screen, riding easy on the golden pony, not caring where I'm going or where I've been. They helped me to escape this world around me. On Sundays at the matinee show, I'm grateful for the times we were together. But the lights came up and then they had to go. Now the time has come to end my story. I dream I'm going back where I belong. I lay my bones to rest in Tombstone City, as good as any place to end my song. Every night I dream of being a cowboy, just like I saw them on the movie screen, riding easy on the golden pony, not caring where I'm going or where I've been. Every night I dream of being a cowboy, just like I saw them on the movie screen, riding easy on a golden pony, not caring where I'm going or where I've been.
Lovely, absolutely. The Brokeback Mountain song. Do you know what I was introducing at the beginning there? I couldn't remember the full title. What is the full title of that song?
Every Night I Dream of Being a Cowboy, but we just call it the Cowboy Song.
The Cowboy Song.
Yeah, it's easy to remember.
Great to meet you,
yeah,
I have
you
to say.
Too, thank you.
And I don't want to age you or anything like that, but I remember as a child growing up and seeing you on TV all the time and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're still going.
Well,
like the writers that Dermot was talking about, they keep going.
Yeah, it's amazing. I find it... amazing that when I think back of when I started, which was nearly 51 years ago, with Mercy and Durkin, and if anybody told me then when I was 21 that I'd be still singing in 2017 and recording and doing radio interviews, I'd have said they were mad.
But when you started out, did you start out to be a professional singer, or was it kind of a hobby part-time thing you
no,
did?
No, it started out as a hobby. I just used to love singing when I was a kid. I was always singing, walking along the street or in the bedroom at night. And it started out as just something nice to do. I enjoyed the crack of it. But then after I realised when people were actually listening to me and asking me to sing, I realised this could be what I want to do.
You had to pay more attention to the lyrics.
Yeah. But no, I realised at a very young age, actually, even long before Máirseann Dorcan, I did a gig in the Gaiety in 1966, in the summer of 66, with Maureen Potter, Danny Cummins, the great Gales of Laughter.
Oh, yeah.
And I had two songs to sing on that. And when I saw them, these highly professional people working, and how much they enjoyed what they were doing, and I really loved what I was doing. I only had two songs to sing near the end. And I remember Maureen saying to me, look, if you're not there on your rostrum at 5 to 10, the show will stop. You know, you are important, even though you've just got two songs. So I think it was that time I said, nah, this is what I really want to do.
Yeah.
And be serious about it. And I had a passion for it that has lasted all these years.
How many albums have you released?
Oh, I don't know, Derek. I don't know.
Would you remember every song you ever sung?
No, I wouldn't remember every song. I would remember some. I can't remember the one I just sang.
the Brokeback Mountain song. The cowboy song, we're calling
the
it.
The cowboy song. I can write a song. It could take a couple of days, you know, but it'll take me about a month to learn it. So I'm not a quick learner.
But you're a quick writer.
It's at times. Sometimes it takes a long time, but most times, it's quite easy. A couple of days.
Well, which comes first, the chorus or the rest of it?
I sit with the guitar and a little recorder, and I sit in a small room at home and I strum the guitar and try to think of a story, or a story would be influenced by something. Like I did one called The Ballad of John Williams, which was influenced by the Titanic, story of the Titanic. But other ones, you just come into your head and you write a line and you carry on, you put it a little bit, sing a few notes with it, and then the next line comes, or mightn't come, the line afterwards might come. So you work, you chip away at it all the time. And one of my failings is that when I have it finished, I find it hard to let it go. I'd be chipping away at it all the time, and I've ruined many a good song by doing the same thing.
Yeah, you do have to actually say, well, that's it now.
That's it, and that's as good
because
as
if you keep going at it, you'll never record
you'll never,
it properly.
No, you're not.
You'll never sing
happy.
It right
you'll
either.
You'll never be happy, no.
Yeah.
No.
Somebody's just been on, sir, what a beautiful bass voice. Oh, they're clearly not talking about me. Gee, I wish I could hire that guy to sing with our choir.
Well, the thing about the voice is that it has changed in the last few years.
It's still strong, though.
It's dropped and got stronger.
Yeah.
In the days when I had a band, I was playing in front of musicians, maybe six people playing behind me, and you had to project. So you were singing louder. You had to try and sing loud to get over the noise of the band, even with amplification. But I think the voice, when I went back to being on my own and singing on my own, I realised I didn't have to sing that high anymore, so I could drop it and sing at a more natural key. And the voice seems to have dropped a lot. It seems more bass now than it was years ago, and I was sort of baritone.
Anna, my boss, would tell me you sang with the Rolling Stones. Is that true?
I'm lucky to survive it.
Why, what happened?
I got a phone call one day, May, but it was 1965 anyway, and a man called Tom Costello, who later became my manager, and I was with him for many years, he rang me up and asked me, you know, would I, and this is before I was known, nobody knew me, would I go on the Rolling Stones concert in the Adelphi Cinema? The old Adelphi.
God.
Of course, I jumped at the idea. Yeah. Not necessarily because it was the Rolling Stones, but it was because it was in a big theatre and it was a gig, and I just wanted to get out there and sing.
Yeah.
So I agreed to do it, and myself and Mike Crotty, who was, we called ourselves the Ramblers, we went along to the back door of the Adelphi, trying to be noticed by people and listening to see if they'd mention our names, which they didn't. And I went inside, and I was approached by one of the crew, and he said, you know, there's a problem here. He said, the compere from England, I don't know his name, but he's chickened out. He's got cold feet and he doesn't want to go on. He said, well, you're on air, would you introduce the acts and would you introduce the Rolling Stones? And because I was young and I was full of courage and ambition and all. So I said, sure, I'll do it. So I wrote the names down on my palm of my hand. There was the Ravens Show Band, there was Julie Grant, the Ivy League, and I introduced all of them. Mm. And then I went on, we did our own spot, and we were on stage. I was singing some Bob Dylan song, like It Ain't Me, Babe, was the one. And I was doing great, and I was really enjoying it. But they couldn't hear me, because there was just a massive wall of sound, screaming and shouting, and all shouting for Mick, you know. And we knew that it wasn't Mick Crotty that were shouting for. So we soldiered on, and I noticed these things coming down through the spotlight. You know, there's these little silver things flashing down, and I sort of said, God, they're throwing jelly babies at us, like like they did for the Beatles.
Yeah.
Well, this is great. We really made with this now. But they turned out to be ashtrays that they were ripping off the back of the seats and throwing them at us.
To get you off?
Yeah. They did it to the whole show, but we didn't know this. And Mick Jagger was hit in the face by one of them, and they stormed the stage for Mick and the Stones. And the show, they only lasted 10 minutes on the stage. But the highlight for me was walking off the stage after. We stuck it out to the end. We were very brave, very stupid, really. But I was walking off the stage, and Bill Wyman was standing in the wings with his bass, and he looked at me and said, "Good gig, man." And that made my day. I've loved him ever since.
Why were they throwing the ashtrays through the show?
It was the young fellas, really. Not the girls were screaming, you see. But the young guys would be jealous, you see. And they were just sort of fellas that would cause trouble anywhere.
But the thought of actually smoking stage, in a... I remember that Adelphi Theatre. The thought of actually smoking in a cinema nowadays...
Exactly. And this, what happened was you'd have the spotlight would be a big beam coming down to the smoke. But they were really... I came across it later on myself, when 2 or 3 years later, and they were screaming for me. And the young guys, there was often a case where I'd have to be locked in the dressing room with these young guys, that they'd have it out in for you, you know.
So you had groupies?
Oh, yeah. But we won't go into that.
Did you like being screamed at?
I found it very frightening at first.
And you were young and they were young?
And they were young, yeah. Right. They'd be all teenagers. I was 21. I found it terrifying, but I liked it as well.
Yeah. See, I was 32 when I did Winning Streak, and they were in their 60s. It was similar, but different, if you know what I mean.
I still have people who came to see me then and would come along. Like last night, I was in Armagh last night, and I met many a person who saw me. You know,
all those years ago and came back again. Terrific.
And
that's
still come.
That's the longevity I was mentioning that documentary, Elton John thing, that you've got a body of work that people liked and still like, and the continuity of your writing skill is still there. And it's progressed with age as well.
Yeah, it's still nice to do the new ones as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's progressed.
If they ask you for a new song, it's a great feeling. But yeah, it's lovely to meet someone who said, "Oh, I saw you... in Kilchamock, and it was 1967, and I met my wife," and I think it just conjures up nice memories for
God,
them.
If only Louis Walsh had been in Kilchamock that night, he'd be managing you and you'd be a boy band.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. I wouldn't be a boy band now.
Well, none of us would. Anyway, get up there and get ready. And I can tell everybody that Johnny is playing tomorrow night at the Everyman in Cork, and all the details of his tour and the album and all that, the new album out, is on our website, rte.ie/mini. Johnny, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
He was old as the mountains, he was young as a child, a little bit crazy, a little bit wild. And he never said nothing, never let words slip, but you knew you could trust him. He shot straight from the hip, and his friends, there were many, but his foes, they all knew. If ever they crossed him, 'twould be the last thing they'd do. But they took it all from him and laid his pride at his feet. To the prison they brought him, where in darkness he lay in defeat, in defeat. A white man betrayed him, his words were untrue. Yes, they took it all from him, the hills and rivers so blue. Now his people are scattered, the young men all gone, and the great chief he died for lies beneath the hot sun. But they took it all from him and laid his pride at his feet. To the prison they brought him, where in darkness he lay in defeat,
in defeat.
The Mooney Show on RTE Radio 1.
It's Saturday. It's the Mooney Show. Time to play Mooney's Saturday Night Quiz.
Yeah, it's time for the quiz, and Sinead Renshaw's in today. Sinead, who have we got, or what's the prize, should I say, first of all?
The prize is fantastic, Derek. It is a two-night break at the Radisson Blu Hotel in Limerick. It's to celebrate their midweek offer, and it's a beautiful, beautiful hotel, views of the Woodcock Mountains. It's in
you sound
20...
like Donald Trump there. It's beautiful, it's a beautiful hotel, it's a great hotel. It's, you're going to have a great time, it's going to be a fantastic time. You're going to have a, you're really going to enjoy yourself, folks.
All accurate, all true.
I know, I've been in it. It's a lovely hotel.
It's, God, it's gorgeous. I was looking at the photos on the website. It's absolutely stunning. The winner will get the two-night break, a superb buffet breakfast on both mornings and dinner on one night on an evening of their choice in Porter's Restaurant.
What do they get for dinner?
No,
that stymied you, didn't it?
I don't have the menu in front
Who's
of me, unfortunately.
Player number one, please?
Player number one tonight is Kevin Hayes, originally from Cork, but now based in Piltown in County Kilkenny.
Kevin, hello.
Hi, Derek. How are you?
Are you in Kilkenny, Tipperary or Waterford?
Actually, I'm in West Cork at the moment, so I came away for the weekend. Okay. I'm in Castletown Bear in County Cork.
Oh, well, that's forgiven. But Piltown kind of borders all of those places, doesn't it?
That's right. It's one of these places with three counties meeting.
And that's them, yeah. Kilkenny, Tipperary and Waterford. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
I'm a resource teacher in a primary school.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Piltown. I have three grown-up sons. I'm away for the weekend in Dodge Canberra, which is a Buddhist retreat centre in Castletown Bear.
Should you be talking to me at all?
Of course I should, yeah.
You're on a retreat. You're supposed to be quiet and kind of mindful.
Contemplative.
You have been? Yes. It's about to end. Right, you have 60 seconds on the clock to answer as many questions as you can correctly. If you don't know the answer to a question, say pass and we'll move on. Are you ready?
Yes.
Your time starts now. Which word beginning with T is the popular name for London's Underground?
A pass.
In which sport do teams compete for the Ryder Cup?
Rugby.
Can you name this U2 song from the Joshua Tree album?
Pass.
How did Vincent van Gogh or Gough sign his paintings?
Vincent.
In Bingo, what number is referred to as Garden Gate?
Pass.
What is the capital city of Libya?
Tripoli.
Who wrote this well-known composition, The Blue Danube?
Pass.
Which canal is located behind the Croke Park Canal End?
The Royal Canal.
Who wrote The Ugly Duckling and The Little Mermaid?
Hans Christian Andersen.
On which mountain did Moses receive the Ten Commandments?
Mount Sinai.
What type of dancers did the artist Edgar Degas often paint?
Ballet dancers.
Ballet dancers, yeah. Not belly dancers. Sinead was trying to put me off there with her belly dancing. You want to see her? She's very good at it too. She's wearing a little...
That sounds good.
Yeah, she's doing her belly dancing and she's got an origami-made bikini on. Right, Sinead, who's player number two? So hang on there. Don't hang up. Kevin?
Okay.
Thank you.
Will do.
Player number two is Agnes Clark, and she is in Kings Court, County Cavan.
Hello, Agnes. How are you?
Hello, Derek.
Very nice to talk to you. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, my name is Agnes. I'm married to Jerry. We have we run a small pub here in Kings Court. We have three children.
Yeah.
And
what are their names?
Well, the eldest is Elaine. She's a national school teacher in a little parish in Bohemine, office between Kells and Navan. Andrew's in Maynooth. He's studying physics or astrophysics in his first year.
Oh, good man.
And Aisling is a second year in the Louis Carrick-Macaulay.
Very good. Are any of them there to help you?
They're all here. I've
great.
A good crew here at the minute.
Let's hear a big shout from them. Hello! 67. George
That's
and Timmy the dog,
excited.
The famous five. 60 seconds on the clock, starting from now. How many world wars were there in the 20th century?
Two.
What is the name of London's largest airport?
Heathrow.
Name this song from U2's The Joshua Tree album.
I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
The most westerly part of the English mainland is called Land's
End.
Saab cars originate in which country?
Sweden.
How many events are there in a decathlon? Decathlon, yeah. Decathlon, I should have said. Sorry. Name the composer of this well-known composition called Ode to Joy.
Mozart.
What Dublin street was once called Sackville Street?
O'Connell.
How many squares are there on one side of a Rubik's Cube?
9.
From which animal is veal obtained?
Calf.
What is the Scouts' motto?
Pass.
What is the minimum number of people needed for a three-legged race?
2.
Who helped Janet Jackson to a Super Bowl wardrobe malfunction? Do you remember?
Sorry?
Janet Jackson, when something popped out. Oh. Who helped her?
Justin Timberlake.
All right, well done. Hang on, don't hang up. Let's get on to the next pair. Who's it, Sinead?
Our final player tonight is Killian Chuldis, and he is from Clontarf in Dublin.
Killian, we just have to go straight to it. Are you ready, Killian?
Yes, I am.
I'm wishing you the best of luck. Your time starts
Thank you.
Now. Traditionally, how many wonders of the world are there?
12.
On what river is Paris built?
The Seine.
Name this song from U2's album, The Joshua Tree.
I haven't found what I'm looking for.
What colour indicates the easiest runs for skiing?
White.
Who became British Prime Minister in 1940?
Churchill.
Who wrote The Hunchback of Notre Dame?
Pass.
Name the composer of the Hallelujah Chorus.
Hayden.
What is the plural of mongoose?
Geese.
What parts of the statue Venus de Milo are missing?
Arms.
What canal joins the Mediterranean and Red Seas?
Panama.
Which story begins, all children except one grow up?
The youngest.
All right, now you've got to hang on there. Don't hang up. We've got to get rid of this commercial break.
The Mooney Show on RTE Radio 1.
Sinead, who has won tonight?
With a score of 11 out of 14, Agnes Clark in King's Court in County Cavan is our winner tonight.
I say Agnes' whole family, including the dog, is the winner. That's all we have time for. Thanks to Sinead. On sound, we had Damon. The producer is Anna Lady. We'll do it all again next week. Coming up, it's Saturday Sport Extra with John
Kenny.
The Mooney Show on RTE Radio 1.